I would like to introduce our guest. Dr. Kelly, MD, is an OBGYN at M Health Fairview Women's Center in Edina. Did I pronounce that right? Or is it Edina?
Nope, that's Edina. Yep, you're right.
Okay. Edina, and co-founder and president of Patient Care Heroes, founding board member for the Minnesota branch of League of Minority Voters, as well as governor of the 7th District of the American Medical Women's Association. This was what really got me like, ooh, wow. She has won the Minneapolis St. Paul Magazine's Top Doctors Rising Star Award for the last 3 years. Her work has made her an invaluable contributor to both local and national publications, news, and podcasts. Her focus is on advocacy and policy change, centering around physicians and medical community, improving the culture of medicine, and making patient care safer. I'm reading it because I don't want to make any mistakes and I don't want to leave out anything because this is very important. You have a very impressive profile and I want our audience to know who you are. She files tirelessly for the right and for the people who don't have a voice. So welcome, Dr. Stetcher. I'm so happy to have you here. And let's start with some of your own personal experiences and how did you, what motivated you to become a physician? And then why did you think of starting Patient Care Heroes?
Yeah, well, thank you so much for having me. It's always amazing to talk to other physicians and people who support the healthcare community. I think right now, especially as we get through COVID, there's a lot of individuals that are struggling and we see a lot of that on the news, right? So we see a lot of mental health concerns. We also, unfortunately, as you know, have physician suicide rates that are higher than the average section of the population.
I was about to touch on that. We'll go into detail later.
So when I was growing up, the biggest thing I wanted to do is be able to somehow help people, right? I think every physician kind of has this almost romantic ideal that if they go into healthcare, they're going to be able to help one person at a time. Maybe that will kind of be like a snowball rolling downhill and potentially could catalyze some real changes. And when I went through medical school and residency, the things that really stood out to me is how passionate I am about women's health. And right. I think for the most part, women have been, I mean, let's be honest, they've been undervalued in society.
Yeah.
They've been undervalued in leadership roles. And there's only about 13% of CEOs of healthcare systems that are women. And these numbers are getting more dramatic now that we've gotten through COVID, because anyone can read the data that's come out. Women have fallen behind even more in terms of equity in the workplace. And so these are huge situations that we need to overcome. And when I was going through training, you see how a man is given accolades for one thing that a woman would be reprimanded for.
Yeah, absolutely.
If I speak with a direct tone, for example, even giving orders, that can be perceived as me being inappropriate, mm-hmm. right? Even if I'm just giving orders in an emergency situation, my intention is questioned, versus a man would be seen as an amazing leader and strong patient care provider. And there's numerous studies that back this up, right? And if you look at nurses and how they perceive a man's intentions versus a woman's intentions, those are very different things even in today's world. And in the culture that I guess I grew up in, right? Because all of us kind of grow up learning these things and witnessing these things. The biggest issue you have is in a lot of hospitals, it's still very 1950s, right? There's still nurses who will bring cookies and coffee to male physicians. They still are listened to more. They're still respected more. There's a lot of discrepancies in terms of how care is provided for patients. And then you look at that bias that can be trickling down to patient care and patient safety issues. Because if I respect you as a physician, I am going to go above and beyond for your patients. If I don't, then that trickles down to how I as a nurse am going to care for your patients as well, right? And so bias in training and bias as we go through the line trickles down from the top down, right? The fish rots from the head is something that I always say, because it's very true. And the culture that is embedded in the system by the CEO is really what everyone sees. And unfortunately, even if you have two or three amazing leaders, they get washed out with a toxic negative culture. And we've all seen that time and time again. And when I look at the treatment of women in medicine, especially, it was quite concerning, because we still put up with harassment, assault, microaggressions, being, you know, told we're not good enough, being held to petty structures because of, unfortunately, we're held to a different standard than most of the men that we work with. And when you think about burnout and depression and anxiety and PTSD, it's no wonder why women are leaving at an alarming rate. And if you look at the data, about, you know, 40% of women will either be part-time or out of medicine by the time they're 6 years out of residency. Absolutely. And that's quite concerning, because if you look at the data, women are awesome surgeons. They're great care providers, and they should be in leadership roles. Yeah. And so when we look at all of this, I cannot separate discrimination based on gender or race from mental health concerns, from policy, from people leaving. And so for me, it was all one big issue that we needed to tackle. And that's why I started Patient Care Heroes, because I really wanted to empower the people in the healthcare system to fix what's broken, to be honest. Because medicine can't fix medicine alone, which is why I'm working a lot in the private sector with national and international organizations, because we, especially women in medicine, don't have the power to make these changes. As much as I've tried, I tried for 2 years to even get a support system in place at my system for 2 years, and it was never green lighted, right? And so just having a support group for people to listen to women who've been harassed or discriminated against was too much to be green-lighted. And so I think we really need to look at that and go, okay, how are we going to fix this? And that's why I decided to start listening to people nationally and internationally, and listening to their stories and listening to where they fit in. And then I talked to people in the legal system, and I talked to people, you know, in every industry, and really business, legal, and healthcare are the three industries that we are very far behind in terms of gender equity and racial equity. And when I looked at what the immediate needs were, really kind of supporting people through their mental health needs was my first task that I wanted to accomplish. And that's why we want to focus on getting people the care that they need. Yeah. Because every day I'm messaged about stories of people who have either committed suicide, that's sending their profile to me, their obituary to me, or people who are on the brink. And I'm going to read a message that I got last night.
Yeah, sure.
From a physician.
Yeah, I wanted to touch on that. Like, I really wanted to talk more about it, not just touch on that, but you know, the physician suicide rates have gone up exponentially.
Yes.
And like, there is not a lot of support systems or like resources in place to sort of give them that outlet. And a lot of people don't want to talk about it. Because I was just reading this article which said that, you know, that you feel, I can tell from my own personal experiences that, you know, you have this fear that you'll be judged.
Yep.
And like, you know, especially as a woman, as a person of color, you think like, oh, you know, my first instinct is, oh no, you know, I don't want to say anything. I just want to like shut down, because I'll be perceived as unprofessional and they'll think I'm not mentally stable or not strong enough. Mm-hmm. So like, I just need to like just put it out.
Yeah. And that is 100% the case. And I will tell you that that's the story that I hear from across the country, countless women, countless people, well, especially in our Black community. And I can't even pretend to know how painful it is to be at the intersection of gender and racial discrimination, right? And so I think one of the other issues we have is not allowing people to speak up, right? And so there's no way I can understand what your experience is. I can only understand what my experience is. And I think we really have this fatal flaw in our system where we have people who assume that they know what your experience is, and that's who's making the decisions, right? So you know, we have all of these chairs of wellness and well-being that are white men, right? And they're making decisions for how women should be addressed in the workplace and how minorities should be addressed in the workplace without even talking to a woman or someone of a different ethnic background, right? And that's really the issue that we have in this country, is we are not going to people who are affected by these issues and saying, how can we fix this? How could we help you deal with these issues? We are just allowing blanket policies to be made by, let's be honest, middle-aged white men, who I adore and love a lot of them. I'm married to one.
Yeah, yeah. I have a lot of friends and I have a lot of,
you know, so this is not anything against that, but I think the people in power need to realize that they have their own biases and they need to be accountable not only to themselves, but the people that they are CEO of. Because, for example, if I bring up an issue about physician suicide and you know, and I really believe people are worth investing in. That's really kind of like the premise of how I move forward. If I bring this up and let's just say a CEO says, well, physician suicide isn't a compelling enough issue to invest in, they're not seeing this from the standpoint of investing in people. They're seeing this from a standpoint of, let's brush this under the rug. Yeah. We don't need to bring attention to this. We don't need to, you know, create, you know, drama around this, right?
Yeah.
Of course, you bring up an issue and you are perceived as disruptive and dramatic. That's something that I've heard from literally 100% of the women across the country that I've talked to. If they are trying to change something, if they're trying to push an idea or policy forward, they are this, you know, evil, disruptive person. Absolutely. And so then people have a fear for their career. And really, when you get down to it, if you are afraid to speak out, if you're afraid to make changes, you go mute, right?
Yeah.
And so you are in survival mode. And that does not drive good patient care or safety either, right? Because you go into burnout mode and you withdraw. And that's when we see a lot of physician suicide as well, not because they have pre-existing mental health conditions, but because they are not empowered to own their truth and to speak up and create these cultural changes that we desperately need. And when I think about the structure of the healthcare systems across the country, this is not one system in particular. Most of us have non-competes, right? In California, they did away with non-competes. And I think that's wonderful, because it's the right to work, right? And if you look at how these things are structured, people often feel trapped in these situations then. And we've also empowered healthcare systems to not care about their employees. Because if you have a non-compete, they're not worried about you going next door and competing with them. And so what are they going to do to keep you? What are they going to do to make sure that it's a safe environment? And in Minnesota, we have Mayo here, and that's supposed to be our premier, you know, everyone says that Mayo is the best, right? In a lot of ways, it is the best.
Yeah, I've heard about that.
And there was a physician there, and you can go to cancerletter.com, look this up, but there was an oncologist physician there, male, who had had sexual misconduct issues, was reprimanded by 3 different states, and he was still allowed to be a mentor and a leader and maintain his job, right? And so there are women who are labeled as disruptive and dramatic and terrible, trying to speak out to fix things, to make it safer for patients, number one, because let's be honest, most of us physicians in healthcare are focused on patients and not ourselves. That's one of those things that honestly we need to be able to
universal truth.
we need to be able to focus on ourselves too, because we need to be healthy. And that's something that a lot of us put in the back burner, especially if we're moms or we're helping to take care of a family. But when we look at this, we're labeled, yet this individual was able to maintain his status, was on task forces, and there was a paper trail, right? And the only reason he was moved off of some of those leadership positions is because journalists uncovered some of these things. And that speaks to exactly where we are at in terms of gender and racial discrimination in healthcare. I'm disruptive if I try to make changes for good reasons. He is a leader and maintains his roles in his job, despite being reprimanded by 3 different state boards.
Wow.
And I think that that is very telling of the culture that we exist in.
The hypocrisy of the standards that they are held and like the other people are held.
Yes, it's totally different. We have a different set of rules, right? And so people, because of what I do and the roles that I have, people will message me and text me all hours of the day and night. And I welcome that. I never want someone to feel alone. So I fully support someone reaching out. We will get you help if you need it. And I truly, from the bottom of my heart, that is what I believe. But I had someone say, I guess in the wee hours of the morning, I'm sitting here on my 10th overnight shift in a row and thinking, what other industry functions like American medicine? None that I can think of. The system is asking me to be more resilient, but it is the system that is broken. Why do I feel so exhausted, depressed, and like such a failure at my job? Increased menial tasks, long hours, lack of respect, and increased documentation have depersonalized what I do. Maybe instead of me being more resilient, we should create a system that supports what we do better. I know I am not alone in feeling this way. And this summarizes
everything.
This could be any number of things from any state, right? Like I get friend requests on Facebook. I get messages on Instagram. I get all these things because people need to know that someone is going to hear them. And my fear is that someone won't hear them and they will be alone and commit suicide, right? And I shouldn't say commit suicide because it is die by suicide. Suicide is a stigmatized term also, and we should get away from using that. But it's challenging for me as someone who's trying to fight against these things and having legitimate ways that we can change policy to hear these things because we aren't heard.
Yeah, that is so true. Thank you. I think that message, thank you for sharing that. I think that just summarizes the whole experience for a lot of people. And they're afraid to just talk about it because, you know, we're afraid of perceptions and, you know, the backlash that follows if you take a stand. Can you tell us a little bit more about the sexual harassment? And have you faced any major challenges in creating a change in that space?
And it's hard because you create policy statements, right? And you create initiatives and then you try to move the needle, right? And so I had a great conversation with Kevin MD. We did a podcast on sexual harassment in medicine. And so I've got a laundry list of things that are easy and free that we could be doing, right? I mean, even just doing away with mandatory arbitration so women don't feel like they're held captive in these situations. And the non-competes is a big one too, right? Like if I'm in a situation where I am unsafe and I'm providing for my family, I should be able to get myself up, move on, and go to a different system that might be safe for me, right? And, and I've talked to many residents, and unfortunately, their experience as much as what my experience was, right? And that is very concerning to me because we've made no headway in 20 years. We've never changed. We've never moved against the status quo. And I think a lot of people who are going through training and they get to the other side of it think that it's going to get better as a physician, as an attending physician, and they realize, you know, it still is what it is. And a lot of people give up because they worry about the perception of themselves, right? So I have gotten numerous messages. I'm, you know, super radical and I'm all these things. And, you know, I've gotten a decent amount of hate messages and that's fine. I accept that I'm not bothered by that one iota because I know what I'm doing is trying to protect, especially our trainees. And so when we've developed these things, I realized that, the institutions, the professional organizations that govern our training, for a long time have been completely resistant to change, right? I think that we need to use the momentum that we have now to create positive changes. I just was asked to join a task force to work in collaboration with the ACGME to work on making training programs safer, especially for women and minorities, because that's a huge issue. We also have huge issues with who's even applying to medical school, right? And so if you look at the data, Black men are not applying to medical school, right? Because why would you put yourself in a situation where you are going to be in a toxic culture? It's a culture that doesn't serve you. It's not a healthy culture. And so we really need to focus on okay, what's the root cause of this, right? Mm-hmm. And so until we fix all the way back to medical school, how we deal with bias training, mm-hmm. how we deal with patients and bias, right? Because women who go to the ER are less likely to be taken seriously about their pain, right? I can even just like tell you my story. And again, I'm not a Black woman, because that would be even more dramatic of an issue. I'm not going to even pretend to know how hard that is. But for me personally, I was in Appleton, Wisconsin for a holiday. That's where I grew up. I grew up in Wisconsin. I almost hate telling people that now, but, so grew up in Wisconsin. I was having this really bad pain, right over where my liver is. Right. And I was in medical school at this time. And so I was not someone who didn't know their body or didn't know what was worrisome. And I went in, and the ER physician, who was male, basically was like, you know, suck it up. It's nothing. And you probably just have gastroenteritis. You probably ate too much because it's a holiday. That's why you're throwing up, like deal with it. Right. And I'm someone who has had kidney stones. I've had kids, I've had sections, you know, all these things. Right. And you know, this pain is bad. It's like a searing pain.
Yeah.
Right? And so I was like, oh, well, that was, you know, $1,000 I shouldn't have spent, or $2,000 or whatever. Because when you are in medical school, you have catastrophic insurance. You don't have insurance. Yeah. Like, you have insurance like that you won't go bankrupt if you're in the ICU, but that's pretty much it. Right. And so came back home, went into the ER the next morning at like 3 or 4 AM. I was getting ready to go back into medical school, because you don't miss in medical school. You don't miss classes because you need to do well. That's a weakness. If you do poorly, it's a weakness if you won't show up. And so I almost passed out in the shower, got taken to Waukesha Hospital by where I trained. And they're like, well, you have a gallstone that's eroding through your gallbladder, and we are going to do emergency surgery. And we're glad you're here. And I was more worried about how long can I go back to school tomorrow?
I know.
Feels coming
up. Priorities are completely different at that point.
I literally said to him, I have finals. Can we wait 2 weeks? And he said, if you want to die, we probably could. But we should probably take care of this issue now. And my sheer panic of, I need to do well on these finals, literally almost made me go, should I just sign out AMA? And that right there is like the crux of the problem, right? I didn't want to be judged. I didn't want to be told I was weak. Yeah. I didn't want people to think I was lying. And you know what? 6 hours after I had my surgery, I was sitting at Starbucks studying for my pharmaceutical final, because I was in the top of the class for that. And I was determined I was going to stay in the top of the class for that class. Yeah. And that is unhealthy on so many levels. But the fact that I, with the privilege that I have in medical school, would not be remotely taken seriously for this horrible pain, like into my pancreas, wrapping around my back, vomiting from pain, white. They didn't even do labs. They didn't do an ultrasound. They didn't investigate it. They just assumed that I was like overreacting and a hysterical woman. And then on the other side of it, I'm having emergency surgery that, again, with the catastrophic, you know, insurance we have, I'm making monthly payments on for years, because it's over $10,000 that we owe. And because I was a medical student, they worked out a payment plan with us because I had no money. Right. Yeah. And so that story, I feel like, really touches on how patients are viewed, right? Yeah. How women are viewed, the training program, because I, as a woman, was never going to say I need help, or I can't do what I'm supposed to do. Like, I'm sitting at Starbucks having a water 6 hours later, desperate to make sure that I did well on this final, because I didn't want to be judged, not to care of myself or having a moment or any of that. And then on this side of it, I, having loans already to pay for my education, don't have a great health insurance plan, and I'm now on top of my hundreds of thousand dollars worth of medical school loans, have another $20,000 in healthcare coverage issues. And so you just look at that story alone, and I, as a white woman with privilege, And yes, I grew up without money. And so I'm sure there's a lot of people whose parents could have helped them with these situations. But as a young person starting out, I wouldn't want that on anybody. I wouldn't want that on my kids, on my, like, that's just like a lot of extra stress. And that was even after the surgeon comped his part of the surgery, because he knew I was a student and had worked with me. So there's just a lot of layers that we have to get through in this healthcare system. And I worry that if we don't make changes, we're going to continue to lose the amazing women that we have currently working, because COVID has really made people realize that they don't have to be in environments where they're not treated respectfully.
Yeah. That is so true. And with that, you know, I just remember that I had a friend who had an ectopic pregnancy, and someone just told her, oh, you know, you just have like abdominal pain and it's nothing. Just take like an antacid and you'll be fine. And like, she could have died. Like, people didn't even take it seriously. And there's this whole body of research that I was going through the other day that said how, you know, African-American women, when they complain of pain, especially with OBGYNs, there it's, you know, have you read that paper?
Yes. So maternal mortality is one of those things that I'm very passionate about.
Me too. That's why.
That's like my thing, right? I'm an OBGYN. I'm a women's health person. Yeah. That is my wheelhouse, right? And I don't know if you saw the Serena Williams documentary.
Yes.
I watched that and I thought everyone should watch that. Right. She's an elite athlete. She knows her body. She's crazy smart. She's, you know, if you're going to put it in blunt terms, she's also a wealthy, famous person. And so if she can't get taken seriously, I don't know what the rest of us are going to do.
And she has the resources and she has, you know, the money.
Yep.
And people know her.
Write a check. Like, if she said, I want a CT PE protocol to look and see if I have PEs, you know, she can just write a check. Like, why are we arguing with someone who's been down this road, has had blood clots before? She knows her body. Her body is a machine, right? She's an amazing athlete. I think, you know, everyone would give a lot to even be 1% of
exactly
who she is. And she could not be taken seriously. So if there's a poster woman for this sort of gender racial equity issue, she is it. And everyone should watch this documentary. And she's brilliant, right? And and so again, with all of these things, the stars aligning for her, she couldn't even get taken seriously. And so it really speaks to the fact that I don't know who can. There was also a physician that was in the news during COVID who died of COVID, a woman, a Black woman, who was an amazing physician. She was not taken seriously for her shortness of breath or trouble,
for her symptoms,
any of that stuff. Right. And so she died because of negligence. And then on the back end of it, people were making comments, oh, well, she was difficult and she was, I'm sorry, but it's my job to treat everyone the same, right? I'm not going to say, oh, she was a crabby person, I'm going to just neglect her.
I mean, that's not an excuse, right?
No, no. Like, how dare we say this about someone who died in our care, right? And so at that point, those individuals who are making those statements for that healthcare system should have been held to account. How dare we go on the back end of it and belittle a woman who died because we didn't give her adequate care? And she documented this on social media. And so there's videos and stories and all of this. And that should also outrage us. This is someone who's one of us in our healthcare system needing help.
Yeah.
And we could not look back if, you know, for whatever reason, we could not help her with that. And so that is alarming on many levels.
Yes, absolutely. So what do you recommend should be the next steps? Like, how do we create that change? Like, okay, we can start with like talking about it. I've started a healthcare consulting and that's how I got into the space. And I learned like, oh my God, like everything is just broken. You know, you work as a physician, but you don't know what the patients are going through. And then when you're doing consulting, you're like, oh shoot, there's like a big disconnect. So how do we go about creating that change?
So, you know, for me personally, I've been trying to work on legislating things because,
yeah,
again, no one entity is going to take responsibility for this.
Yeah.
And the problems are too
complex
and complex and multi-layered that I don't think that any one professional organization can take it on either. No. Right. And so I think when you're faced with such a daunting challenge, the ACGME or the AMC or the AMA or any of these organizations, even though they seemingly mean well, can't fix this. They can't hold people to account. I do think that if a medical school or healthcare system residency training program cannot fulfill a safe work environment for people, like a minimum standard, they should be decredentialed. And I don't understand why that is such a huge concept to grasp, because if you can't create an environment where people can safely report harassment, assault, discrimination, and not be retaliated against, I don't think you should be allowed to be an academic training program, personally.
Right.
But if you look at that and you look at the mental health needs, there was just this bill that Tim Kaine had introduced, the Breen bill. I know Tina Smith here in Minnesota worked on that as well. And we were trying to create addendums to that. And the reason being is, yes, money is great, research is great, but you need to have tangible action items on there so that we can move the needle forward in terms of people not feeling trapped. Kind of like we talked about the non-competes and the mandatory arbitration, those should be
right in
the past. There shouldn't be NDAs that anyone is saddled with, especially when you look at some systems having that baked into their contract before you even start, right? So I shouldn't have to sign a preemptive NDA unless you're planning on treating me poorly, right? And so I think that should be a thing of the past, and those would not cost the government anything. Also talked with multiple people about doing national oversight, since clearly one professional organization cannot handle this. And so there's actually an amazing, there's an amazing company that has a technology that they built around keeping the LGBTQ community safe. And so it actually has a very, I don't want to get it wrong. Do you know what I mean?
Okay, no, that's fine. You can just send me the link and I'll put it in the link.
So Lisa Gus is the CEO and co-founder. And she's on she's
that
on-
sounds very intriguing and very interesting.
So Wish Knish, and I don't know if I even said that right, but I want to work with her to develop a safe reporting structure, because if we have something that's nationally readily available and people don't feel safe in their work environment in the healthcare world, we can use that to help them. Right. And so if you don't have a safe reporting structure, I want you to have another option. So at some point in all my other projects, we're going to be crowdfunding so that we can use that technology. I think it also would be kind of a wonderful thing to use to report voting intimidation issues. Because really, what is amazing about that is it's encrypted. You can report things anonymously. You can upload different videos and data and evidence. And they also have the chain of custody baked into it as well. And so you can actually use these for legal proceedings. And so when we talked, we looked at trying to use these on many different levels to help healthcare, voters, voter intimidation. And it could be very useful for many applications to keep people safe. And so we need to have a system where we have oversight, where we have somebody who can help someone who is struggling. And that's really the end game, I think, because if you start having people being held accountable, having ramifications for their actions, not just retaining their jobs and their titles and their leadership positions, and their mentorship positions, because I think that that's where a lot of women really struggle. I had to leave and he still has his job. That's an issue I hear almost every day. Like I was
That's the common, this is how it goes.
You
know? Yes. How it treated,
like garbage, boom, goodbye. Even though I was a successful, wonderful person, great at my job, and he has his job and there's no ramifications, and maybe he, you know, goes to therapy, right? Or maybe he goes to anger management or whatever it may be. And that is a story I hear all the time. And so someone needs to hold these people accountable, and someone needs to be able to hold the health systems accountable that enable these people complicit in this abuse.
Absolutely.
Because at the bottom line is There's no one in this country that doesn't know if someone is a little shady, right?
Yeah.
When I was told in residency, smile more, wear more makeup, have my chest talked about, have my butt talked about by an attending physician, and I reported it to our residency director, he goes hunting with this individual, right? There was nothing that happened other than I basically was retaliating. And these were, and I didn't even say anything when it was just me and him. I said something because he was talking about my body in a patient room.
Right.
You don't talk about my body or my weight or my chest or my butt or any of that in front of a patient, a GYN oncology patient who has endometrial cancer that we're post-oping. You don't get permission to talk about how, you know, I would be attractive if I lost 20 pounds. I'm going to have endometrial cancer if I don't. You don't get that luxury to do that. And the fact that he was, that's just how he is, right? That's just him. That's his personality. That's what he does. That's how he treats everyone. He typically picks one person each year to kind of bully like that. And we accepted that. Like we had to accept that.
That's the main problem. Why do we accept that?
Yes. No one would help me. And, you know, and it's so shocking because no one stood up and said, this is not appropriate, except there was one female attending who went with me to a meeting and stood up with me. And she was then also treated poorly. Right. And in no world is that okay. In no world should that be accepted. And even if you get down to it, being professional in a patient room should be the bottom of the barrel minimum. Yeah.
The bare minimum.
Like, I'm not even saying don't talk about my body in the hallway. I'm just saying don't talk about my body in front of a patient that I'm caring for that has cancer. And that was too much. That was too much to ask for. And, it's those moments though. And the fact that I hear those over and over and over and over again with no change that we really need to fix this issue.
Yeah. Absolutely. Was there a backlash? Were you scared?
Yes, there was it. Yes. You become the black sheep, right?
Yeah.
You don't say anything because now this person's going to target you.
Yeah.
You have to do presentations at residency, you know, meetings and whatnot. He's going to like get in your face. And it's going to be real ugly. It was not comfortable, you know, and I had a relatively benign, wonderful training program in it compared to the vast majority
of what other people go through.
And so that being said, you know, it really creates this fear because, okay, I'm not a board certified OBGYN and I have, you know, $250,000 worth of debt. What if I can't graduate residency because this individual with a lot of power tries to sabotage my career, right? Yeah. And so then you live in fear that someone is going to come after you in your career. And that's no way to live or train or learn about healthcare or try to protect patients. That's no way to thrive. And so you have many, many thousands of women who are in survival mode, are not allowed to thrive, are not allowed to generate ideas or fix systems, are not allowed to be promoted into leadership. It's easier for me to get on a national task force than it is to get into leadership in a healthcare system. And so when you look at that, it's no wonder why people are leaving medicine.
This is so true. I think you've just summarized it beautifully. And I think this is what a lot of people go through, but they just don't have the resources or the time to talk about it or even, you know, to bring it out openly because, again, the fear of backlash and everyone is just concerned about, you know, the career ramifications.
That's exactly
right. You know, how it would reflect on them. I have a question that Dr. Samantha Winemaker has sent across, and she wanted me to talk about this with you. I'll just quickly like tell you. She says that our death-denying healthcare culture through training and practice results in many patients and families facing progressive life-limiting illness to remain in the dark about their natural history of their illness. As physicians, we know that COPD, PD, ARS, and many cancers, including dementia, et cetera, not just chronic illnesses, They progress, change, worsen, become advanced, and then terminal. However, we fail to prepare the patients with this knowledge because the medical culture is uncomfortable walking two roads with the patients. We need to teach healthcare providers that hope and reality about an illness can exist simultaneously. This is the single most cost-saving healthcare innovation out there.
Yeah. I mean, so I have a couple books coming out. My first is The Future Female Leader. That's going to be out in August. I wrote the first chapter on that, and that's called Authenticity Leadership, right?
Yeah.
And then my second will be out in 8 to 12 weeks called Delivering Love. Fisher King Publishing out of the UK is publishing that. And that's a memoir. And really, I look at a lot of these issues because you have to lean into this. You have to be an authentic human being. I think the culture that was established that is not working for us is much the culture of why we have the gender racial discrimination issues in medicine. We have this sense of we are better than, right? And it's, I hate to say it, but a lot of it is kind of like this almost like white supremacy concept, right? When one group thinks that they are better than another group in any way, this is why you have these issues. If I feel like I know better than you about your own body, that's why we have these issues. That's why we have reproductive rights issues. That's why we have people who haven't taken a day of biology creating policy on contraception and calling it an abortus, you know, saying that it's a abortion causing when it's absolutely not scientifically proven not to be the case, right? So we have a crop of people who think that they know better. And really, it's a team sport. Being a physician, being in healthcare should be a team sport.
Yes,
I should tell you, oh, you have bleeding, you're getting a hysterectomy. I should tell you, okay, you have fibroids, these are the sizes, these are the statistics. Mm-hmm. We can try a Mirena IUD to help with bleeding. We could try this, we could do a myomectomy, we could do a hysterectomy. You should know all of the things, the good, the bad, the ugly. And I still feel like we live in a culture where people don't give appropriate informed consent. There's no time when I say, okay, I'm going to do a DNC and it's risk-free. No, I should be able to tell the patient, you know, risk of infection, risk of bleeding, risk of perforation of the uterus, risk of further surgery. Like, there's no way I should be withholding important clinical information from a patient. It's her body, right? And I think it really speaks to, again, the separation when people think they're better than. I mean, and that is rooted in, again, leadership. There's no time when I have told someone that I'm higher up than you, right? There's no time when I've used the word, okay, we're higher up, we're better than, we're this. We should be a team working forward to improve whatever it is to improve. I should be empowering you, if you're coming to me with a problem, to not only say thank you for helping us realize this problem, but to move it forward and to enhance the experience for our patients and our staff. Wow. So, and I think that it's just so hierarchical in its structure that we have this patriarchal hierarchy, and that trickles down. And so that really gets to the root of all of it. And I just, that actually made me think of actually a quote from Joe Biden. And I'm going to read it because I want to make sure that I get it right. And I think that when he said this last night, and he also said it when he was elected, he also said it, I think, at his inauguration, but this 100% speaks to healthcare as well. lead not by example of power, but power of our example. And I think that is our issue. We are so much in this I'm better than you attitude that we forget that we're a team and we all want the same things.
Yeah, absolutely. That is 100% correct. And how would you, I was looking at like, how do you stay motivated? I'm sure when you have all these, you know, there's setbacks and then you have, you know, areas where you feel frustrated. How do you stay motivated? How do you keep going?
You know, that's a really good question. Sometimes I wonder. And honestly, it's these stories, you know, a 1 a.m. message on a social media because someone found something that I said, or someone's mom reaching out to me because they heard my sexual harassment podcast and think their daughter could benefit from it, or all these things motivate me because I know that I'm not fighting for myself, right? And that's another thing that women in medicine in particular have a hard time. Again, we forget the self and we try to focus on the others, right? And so if I was just doing this for me, I would be done, right? Which I know is kind of like a horrible thing to think about, but I know I have thousands of women behind me and I hear from many of them every single day. And I have thousands of minorities behind me and I hear from them every single day. And I think it's important for me to stay grounded in why I'm doing this and focused on my purpose. Because yes, it is a lot. It's a lot to take messages. It's a lot to be called names. It's a lot to, you know, hear awful things about yourself. And then you go into your own day job, right? Because that's the only job that I have that pays me. The rest of this is my passion projects.
Right.
So you go into your day job and you feel like, I can't even fix anything here. How can I fix anything at all?
Exactly.
Right? So then what? Right. So then what? And so then you have to empower yourself to realize there's a bigger purpose here. You're not going to fix it on your own. You're going to chink away at the problems and we're going to do this together. And that's why I started working with national and international organizations, because I know as an OBGYN from Minnesota, I cannot fix these issues.
Right.
But as an OBGYN from Minnesota and the American Medical Women's Association and the League of Minority Voters and the Wellbeing Trust and, you know, the Australian Mental Health Individual and the dynamic people in the UK that do Mindspace 24/7. And, you know, when I get my coalition, then we become powerful. Right. And so I think it's important to know that no one is alone, that there are people here that will go to the end of the earth for you. And I just don't want someone to be in this moment where they're feeling trapped and hopeless and not be able to reach out to someone. That's my biggest goal from all of this, is just to try to protect people and save people's lives, because I know how quickly it can go wrong.
Right. Absolutely. I think that's of paramount importance. Thank you so much, Dr. Kelly. It was wonderful. And especially after the fourth, you woke up at 9 a.m. So I think that's like difficult at times, but thank you so much.
Okay. I have kids. So, you know, they don't let you sleep past about 5:30 anyway. So
Right. And I'm really looking forward to your book. I look forward to reading your book and thank you for all the wonderful things that you're doing. And hopefully we'll be chatting more and keep this conversation going, because I think that this is what's going to drive the change that we're looking for.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you. Take care. Bye-bye.